Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, will there ever be another Earth? How's that for a topic for the hour? The UW Fox Valley Barlow Planetarium has that as its evening discussion for this coming Friday. Is it this Friday? Next Friday. Next Friday, a week from Friday, September 5. And it's at 7 o'clock in the evening, and it's free, but you should register. It's presented by Dr. Maggie Turnbull, who's an internationally known astrobiologist. Her expertise is identifying star and planetary systems that are capable of supporting life. She has been named in Wired Magazine's Smart List of 2012 50 People Who Will Change the World. She runs the Global Science Institute from her home in Antigo. It's a nonprofit organization in northern Wisconsin dedicated to the sustainable expansion of humanity's frontiers. Dr. Turnbull is a freelance astronomer, astrobiologist. She was lead scientist in developing NASA's New Worlds Observer mission, a concept for a space telescope. This is still underway to discover Earth-like planets around nearby stars. And she uses the North Woods as her base, which is terrific. She will be speaking, and she is with us for the first half of our program today. Dr. Maggie Turnbull, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm terrific. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
our great pleasure. And Alan Pesch is joining us as well. Alan will be here for the full hour. It's been a while since we talked to Alan. He's director of the Barlow Planetarium. He's been there since 2008. He's worked as planetarium curator at Louisiana Arts and Science Center and flight and space director of the Museum of Science and Industry in Tampa. Alan, you always have great things going on, and thank you very much for doing what you do and for entertaining Maggie in this terrific evening that will take place.
This is the stuff we do that's really, really, really fun.
I know. I know it is, and it's fun for all of us. So, Maggie, let me just talk about, you live in Antigo. I understand that you're there partially because you're a naturalist, you're really into the earth, but you also can see summer, spring, winter, fall, very clear skies, all the better for viewing what's going on in the heavens, right?
Well, I think that, you know, it's the earth side of me that really loves being in the North Woods. Mm. And, you know, the sky part of me, it also appreciates it because, you know, we do have a lot less light pollution, obviously, when you get away from the bigger cities. And
yeah.
I've always thought that actually the North Woods in the dead of winter is the absolute best, one of the best places to be for observing the sky, just because we get those super ultra cold temperatures and there is just no water in the atmosphere at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just really, even just naked eye, I mean, the sky is so spectacular that time of year up there. But I mean, for the most part, really the science that I do doesn't require that I be at an observatory all the time. I mean, nowadays, with the internet, you know, astronomers are working with each other all over the country and even doing remote observing, you know, at mountaintops comfortably from our desks at home, wherever we live.
Right.
So I had to weigh the pros and cons and finally decided I just wanted to live somewhere that I could really enjoy the natural environment on a daily basis.
Yeah,
and then I would just work extra hard to stay in contact with all my colleagues.
Yeah, it's a good choice. When I say that your expertise is identifying star and planetary systems that are capable of supporting life, tell me, and it would probably take a long time to do this, but what's all involved in that? How in the world do you identify those star and planetary systems? What are you looking at?
Right. Well, in most cases, we just have very limited information. The stars are very far away. Even the nearest ones are very far away. So we have to kind of put together all the pieces of information that we have for these individual systems and try to imagine then what those stars would be like to live around. And could they actually host a planet like ours? Or any kind of planet that has liquid water on it, which is kind of the the baseline for habitability, as far as we know. You have to have liquid water in order to have the kind of chemistry that life depends on. But there are a whole bunch of factors that go into that that we can kind of make headway on. And no two stars are the same. I mean, all the stars are suns, and the sun is a star, but no two of them are exactly the same. So when we think about things like, is it a single star like the sun, or does it have a companion? And if it does have a companion star, what kind of orbit is that star on? And that's something we can know from the ground, you know, from, you know, without going there. We can figure that out with telescopes. And then there's other things too, like what are those stars made of? You know, some stars have very little metal content in their atmospheres because they formed in a part of the galaxy that just was not very rich in metals.
Mm-hmm.
And planets form out of that stuff too. So if you don't have any metals around, heavy metals, and by that I mean basically everything heavier than hydrogen. Astronomers refer to metals as anything heavier than hydrogen, including carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, silicon that the rocks are made out of, iron that's in our blood and is also in the planet. And if a star forms in a region that does have those things around, then you can imagine it might also have planets, you know, that are made of those things, and potentially life forms that take advantage of those things as well.
Mm-hmm.
But some stars don't have any of that material. They're just pure hydrogen and some helium. And then, you know, maybe just a tiny little smattering of heavier elements. But you can imagine that would be it would be more difficult to form planets, especially terrestrial rocky planets, in a system like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of things like that that we can point to. And even though we can't go there right now and see what they're like, or, you know, even we're not even capable really today of detecting planets in those systems, especially lower mass planets like our own, we can still point to a lot of things like that would indicate whether it would be a habitable stellar system or not.
Mm-hmm. When you think, and Ellen, I want you to respond to this as well. I've always had this, I mean, it's just a little fantasy, but I've always thought during my lifetime we would discover not only that we saw life on other planets, but that it would be some kind of intelligent life. And somehow we were going to make contact, and it was going to change everything. And in my dreams, and I've had a lot of dreams about this, it was always for the better, that the life was more intelligent, it was peaceful, it was able to guide us in some new way, and we all listened, and it was all good. So when you think, and I know you've been asked about this, but when both of you think in terms of life, you're thinking in terms of maybe a kind of life that we never even thought could exist, maybe a continuum you talk about it, a continuum of life. What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, first of all, and I want to hear what Ellen has to say too, but I find this fascinating that you have dreams about this, Kathleen.
Yeah, I do too. They're always good.
Talk more about that. Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. We start with what we know. So, you know, the whole idea of a habitable stellar system being, you know, having these different qualities and characteristics that point to habitability for life as we know it. That's a starting point. But, you know, even if we had another system that was identical to our own, there were so many events in the history of life and the history of this planet that led up to where we are today that I just can't imagine, you know, even if you could start over with a twin, exactly the same situation and setup with a one star and same array of planets, that it would end up in the same exact state that we're in now.
Mm-hmm.
Because of things like asteroid impacts and, you know, the planets perturbing each other a little bit and shifting around in their orbits and things evolving in really unpredictable ways because of these random events that occur. So I don't think, you know, I think we could simultaneously be common and rare. Like, there could be life everywhere, but no two of them the same.
Mm. Ellen, do you think? What do you think, Ellen?
Yeah. I like these questions because they're the questions I get from kids.
Right.
And usually want to go through that process and go, okay, you go outside at night, even here in the Fox Cities, and there's hundreds of stars that you can see. And then they kind of get to this idea, does it make sense for us to be the only one?
Right.
And then they start doing that next step. And then it comes up to the science fiction people to write stuff. And now, just recently, the technology is catching up to where we can actually explore some of these things, like with the Kepler spacecraft, which is looking for planets orbiting stars, and the European Space Agency. Now, these probes cannot determine exactly, but for the people like Dr. Turnbull who wants to go to the next step, these are the spacecraft that wean the numbers down and say, you know what, you don't have to look at this one. But here are some other ones that are a possibility. And, boy, I like that you think that there was going to be life discovered in your lifetime. I think that's really cool. I'm still waiting to go to Mars.
we've all got our thing, right?
but the technology is just amazing on how some of this stuff wasn't possible even a fraction of a generation ago.
Right.
And now they're working on projects that are going to be looking for that next step of weaning it down even more and hopefully soon at least get some more what we like to call Goldilocks planets,
mm-hmm.
the planets that are just right.
Yeah. Dr. Turnbull, you mentioned telescopes. I know you've been lead scientist in developing NASA's New Worlds Observer mission, which I understand is a space telescope that would be looking for some of these possible Earth-like planets that aren't too far away from us. How is that progressing?
Well, okay, so the New Worlds Observer is a concept for what we call a flagship class mission. It's a big... This is NASA's biggest category for a mission. It would be a large space telescope flying, and in this case, there would actually be a second spacecraft called a Starshade. And the Starshade is basically a gigantic screen, and it happens to be shaped. It has petals. It's star-shaped. I'll show a picture of it at my talk next Friday. And we are actually prototyping this in the lab. We had some students at the Jet Propulsion Lab that were working really hard all summer to build a small-scale model of one of these, and I have some pictures of that as well now that those students are all heading back to college for the fall semester. But what we're looking at now is a probe class version of the same thing. So New World Observer is the flagship class. It's going to, it would be a gigantic space telescope, much larger than the Hubble Space Telescope, flying with this second spacecraft. And that Starshade would align with the telescope in order to block out the light of a nearby star so that we could see the faint little specks of light around it that are the planets orbiting it. And that's crucial. You have to find a way to block out the light of the star so you can actually see these faint little planets. But that's, you know, a flagship class mission like that, that's huge. And that, you know, that's, we're talking decades to really figure that out and also come up with the funding to be able to support that. So what NASA did, and I don't know if you guys heard about this, last year NASA was actually gifted two Hubble-class telescopes by the National Reconnaissance Organization, the NRO. Mm-hmm. And these are spy satellites. It's a whole suite of spy satellites.
Huh?
And we didn't know at the time when Hubble was launched. I don't think it was widely known that this was, you know, an example of one of those telescopes. Hubble is one of those telescopes. And there were just apparently, you know, here NASA is, you know, looking for nickels and dimes to be able to move forward on this. And then, you know, and then the DOD comes up with these two spare Hubble that are just laying around.
Oh, my.
Don't need them anymore. So, you know, hey, would you guys like these? And so that sort of threw the whole, you know, future missions plan into a little bit of a tizzy because suddenly we had these new resources that seem like they should be used for something good. And so what we're looking at now is the possibility of, you know, it has pretty much been decided that one of those telescopes is going to be used for WFIRST is the name of it. It's going to be a space observatory, same size as Hubble, going to, you know, explore the farthest reaches of the universe. It's going to learn about dark matter and dark energy and all these great things. And what we're looking at is the possibility of flying a starshade with that then so that we can also turn it into a next-generation exoplanet observatory so that we'd be able to actually image and detect, you know, even Earth-sized planets potentially around some of the nearest stars and start getting into the Goldilocks zone of some of these stars and see if there's any planets there.
Ooh.
So there's that. And then NASA actually commissioned two teams to work on even a smaller, what we call a probe class concept for just a standalone. We're going to build our own little telescope with our own little gigantic starshade and fly them, and it can only cost up to $1 billion maximum, which I know to you and I, $1 billion sounds like a lot, but for a government program like this, and really to put a telescope in space, I mean, that's your bottom dollar. I mean, you can't go less than that.
Yeah.
To put an observatory in space.
Yeah. That's something. We're welcoming phone calls. Dr. Turnbull is with us for the first half hour. Alan will remain with us for the whole hour. But here's how you join our conversation. You need to get your calls in quickly for her. She's an internationally known astrobiologist. She's going to be speaking. The title of the talk is "Will There Ever Be Another Earth?" It's Friday, September 5, 7 p.m., and it's at the UW Fox Valley Barlow Planetarium, a great place. Alan is the director of that planetarium and a former physics teacher. He is with us as well. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. John on Facebook, let's have you respond to this. Dr. Turnbull says, only by being either incredibly arrogant or by having absolutely no concept of the sheer volume of planets and stars could you believe for a second that life could only form here. What do you think?
Well, I guess, you know, that's, I guess I tend to sort of lean in that same direction and just, I guess the way that I travel through my days every day is that I'm pretty comfortable being in a state of not knowing. Like, I just don't know. And so for me, it's the energy, you know, that I put into that is all about what do we need to do next in order to get closer to finding out. It's kind of an uncomfortable thing, I think, for people to not know something. Mm-hmm. And each day goes by and we still don't know. But for scientists, not knowing is like our normal state of existence. And so we're really comfortable with that. And then we just apply ourselves, you know, all of our energy goes towards whatever the next tiny little step is towards finding out the answer.
Alan, what do you think of that?
Well, and that statement is completely true. I mean, if you look at the complete numbers and just recently, they pretty much believe that there's planets around every star. So when you go outside tonight, Kathleen, and look at the stars, they're actually seeing more planets than there's actually stars in the sky. Because each one of those little dots probably has multiple planets or multiple planets around them. So it's finding out how that happens. And like Dr. Turnbull said, it's the steps that the scientists have to take. And scientists love not knowing stuff because it gives them a challenge to start learning something, to know more about it. And even I think Richard Feynman, the physicist, said it's what gets him up in the morning. Of not knowing something, and I have to learn it.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls. Steve in Madison, hi.
Hello?
Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi. This idea is very interesting. Now, assuming that there are other planets that have life, what would be your thinking about anything like similar to the diversity of life on Earth, as opposed to, you know, just a much less diverse system?
Dr. Turnbull.
Well, you're right. Yeah, I mean, no, this is very true. Earth is not only incredibly diverse today, but, you know, if you look at the Earth 100 million years ago or a billion years ago, it's totally different. You know, it's a different planet even, you know, in terms of the life and you know, even just the superficial appearance of the planet. So, you know, just given that sheer diversity, I feel that it could be almost anything, you know, looking at another planet. And I don't see how we could expect, you know, less diversity, really. Than, I mean, it's just hard to imagine. You know, we have so many different kinds of environments here, and many of those environments were actually created by life, you know, those little niches of habitability. So it seems like an extremely nonlinear system. I bet Alan has a much more coherent response to that.
Oh, wow. Well, and just because there's life has been around on Earth for a very, very, very long time. And Earth had to run through its paces for the last 4.6 billion years to the point of a little bit more than a century ago, we finally measured the speed of light, or even knew that light had speed. And we could, I mean, if we'd run into an exact Earth 500 million years ago, it'd be a complete, and we wouldn't understand what was going on completely. But how do we work with that? How do we know that? Or what if we go the other end? What if we run into an Earth that's hundreds of thousands of years ahead of ours? So it's a fantastic,
right,
philosophical discussion when we're just looking at wow, is there life out there? Is there something that is life out there? Even if it's single-celled, if it's us, if it's some whatever, mm-hmm. it's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
It's great because we're on this quest to find Earth-like planets around nearby stars. And if you just stop and ask, you know, well, what do you mean by Earth-like? Because even the Earth isn't Earth-like if you look at it a billion years ago.
Right.
So
right.
there's a huge range of diversity even within that category of Earth-like.
I just want to stop the conversation and think about that for a while. I can't because it's radio, but oh my goodness, that's something to contemplate. Thank you, Steve, for your call. Peter in Boulder Junction. Hi.
Hi. Whenever I hear scientists are looking for water on other planets and so on to see if there might be life there, is there some reason that other forms of intelligent life would have to use water? Could they exist on methane or any other elements, or maybe their periodic table of the elements on another intelligent planet isn't even anything like ours? Is there some reason their planet would have to have our elements
yeah.
to have intelligent life?
Good question, Dr. Turnbull.
No. Well, yes. Yes and no. I mean, life as we know it really does tap into the awesomeness of water, the water and carbon chemistry that really water has so many fabulous properties. I mean, for example, it remains liquid all the way from 0 degrees Celsius up to 100 degrees Celsius. That's a huge range of energy for any medium to remain liquid. And that all in itself opens up, you know, huge possibilities for life in all different kinds of environments all over the planet, including frozen environments where even just a little bit of salt can give you a liquid environment. So water has some really fabulous properties for the kind of complex chemistry, especially carbon-based chemistry, that allows really complex little assemblies to come together, little molecular motors and proteins and things that as of today, there just isn't another combination of, you know, for example, ethane-methane, liquid ethane-methane plus maybe, you know, silicon chemistry or something. I mean, there isn't another combination like that adds up to the kind of potential that we see with water and carbon. And there's just been so many different articles written about this because, yeah, I mean, don't you wonder about alternative biochemistries? And sure, you know, that's definitely something that I think most scientists would love to see or tap into somehow if it does exist out there. For now, it's just a matter of starting with what we know and branching outward from there. And then also asking the question, why is water and carbon so fabulous? And there's actually been a lot of work done on that. That's a whole cool topic all in itself.
Mm. Let's take one more phone call for you, Dr. Turnbull. Ellen is staying with us for the full hour. Kathy in Chautauqua. Hi, Kathy.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering if there was any new information on the existence or non-existence of Planet X.
Well...
Does anybody know about this? I don't know anything about it.
Well, Planet X has been around for a while. And, in fact, if you really want to go back into the history of astronomy, when we've always had the what we call the visual planets, the Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And when they started to branch out and look for the other planets, they would tentatively call that Planet X when they were looking for it. And sure enough, they found Uranus. And then Neptune, ironically, was discovered by mathematicians who told the astronomers where to look because Uranus was doing something strange. And then they tried to do it at Pluto, and it never worked at Pluto. So there is another version of Planet X that is out there, that it was something out there we couldn't find that's a part of our solar system. And with our technology now, thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope and our other space telescopes and even our adaptive optics of our Earth-based telescopes, stuff in our solar system that would be large enough, those telescopes could probably observe very well. Mm-hmm. And now we're looking at dwarf planets that are much further out than Pluto, sometimes a little bit bigger than Pluto. So I don't think we're going to be discovering a major planet going around in our solar system, but there's a lot of those dwarf planets, I think, that are just waiting to be found.
Thank you, Kathy.
You know, something interesting to add to that, this is just recent, in the last few months here, it looks like from the dynamics of some of these so-called Kuiper Belt objects, beyond the orbit of Pluto, that there could actually be even an Earth-sized planet out there, you know, far, far beyond. This is just recently, like in the last couple of months here, that some of my colleagues have been talking about this. I'll try to know more about that by the time we get together next Friday.
Okay.
Good.
And Ellen is staying with us. Dr. Turnbull, thank you so much for being with us. And we urge everybody, I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating evening next Friday, September 5, 7 o'clock
thank
at
you.
The Barlow Planetarium. Please join us again, won't you? Thank you.
Yes, I hope so. Thanks so much.
Good.
And I'm really looking forward to next week. It's
great.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Great,
okay.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And you need to, Ellen will tell us more about the event. It is free, which is terrific as well. It's a beautiful place, and you just need to make a reservation because it could get kind of crowded when you're talking about, will there ever be another Earth? Ellen is staying with us. Ellen is the director of the Barlow Planetarium. He's been there since 2008. He is filled with enthusiasm. It's a great planetarium, and he throws quite a show and quite a party. So that, mark it down and be sure and go. We'll take more phone calls. We have more emails here with us now. So our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And people have been leaving messages on our Facebook page, too, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Alan Pesch remains with us, director of the Barlow Planetarium. Earl in Medford, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Thanks. It's a great time to be alive, as someone said. I just have a question on the signals from other planets, the search for extraterrestrial activity, which has been going on for decades now. Can that be coordinated with what we're doing now with the telescopes? So we could get two takes on what might be out there and whether there's civilization?
Well, Earl, thanks for calling from Medford, my old stomping grounds. I would have to say I think it would be one of those steps. But I want to let you know one thing. that when we start looking for SETI, we're doing the SETI search, is we're looking for a subset of these planets that would be able to create signals that we could interpret. So it'd have to be a planet that would be similar to ours, that had similar or more advanced technology than ours. I mean, one cool thing to think about is all those shows that were being broadcast out in the 1950s are now about 50 light years away from Earth. So there could be some civilization out there that's on a planet who has a SETI program as well, that's watching reruns of the Lucille Ball Show. And that would be our signal out to the universe. So I think this is a multi-pronged study where, as Newton said, you get to see further because you get to stand on the shoulders of giants.
Mm.
And just the stuff that's been created with the Kepler project and the Corot project is a stepping stone for us to find these planets out there that could possibly have some that are just the right distance away from their suns, not too hot, not too cold, and be able to support life if everything else came about as well.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Earl. Mary in Whitewater, hi.
Hi. I was wondering why your guests haven't really referred much to this incredible documentary by NOVA that's just been uploaded to YouTube, and it's called Alien for Planets Like Earth with the Universe. It's a full documentary, and it does zero in on what the Kepler telescope is discovering, and it's mentioned a lot of things that have been mentioned by your guests today, and it's extremely graphic and very powerful. And I haven't heard much mention of it at all, other than Kepler was just mentioned.
Well, I haven't gotten to that yet. I'm excited about Kepler, and it shows you how many people out there are actually participating with this. I had the opportunity to review one of Dr. Turnbull's interim reports last night, and she mentioned some things that she was being very, very modest on how she was saying things. She was talking about the Starshade project, and we always think about the shade that they're developing as this, oh, it's nice, it's this thing this thing is tens of meters across and has to fly in precision formation with the observing telescope and over a distance of hundreds of thousands of kilometers. So that type of program just gets to show you that there's multiple places in the United States, European Space Agency, that is interested in this question. And Kepler is finally back to working at a limit where it was used to when it lost one of its gyros. But boy, the science even Kepler developed for us or gave us has been amazing at identifying the next step of these planets that we can go out and look for.
Mm. Thank you, Mary, so much for your call. Alan Joe on Facebook says, statistically, it seems improbable that life doesn't exist elsewhere, given the massive number of galaxies, each with billions of stars and planets. The trick is encountering such life, given the limitations of space, time, and the laws of physics. Perhaps, as in the Sagan book film, Contact, intelligent life somewhere will harness wormholes to travel space-time without these hurdles. Even so, they would have a huge geography to cover in order to stumble upon us.
Dr. Turnbull mentioned something that I kind of had a smile about because of how she said it, that something to the effect of that there could be a lot of life, but it could be rare. And that is one of those problems of that the universe is so incredibly large that it's a complete possibility that life could be everywhere and still not be able to contact each other.
Oh, my goodness.
And never encounter each other.
Right.
I like to give students a little thought experiment. If I drop you in a typical place in Wisconsin, what do you see around you? Probably woods.
Mm-hmm.
However, if I drop you in a typical place in the universe, you won't even see stars. It'll be so much in the middle of nowhere.
Mm.
between the galaxies that it is a really, really large place, and you could have life a lot of places, but in our human lifetime, within 100 light years of light, 100 light years of travel time, you may not encounter life. But boy, there's a lot of those 100 light year measurements out there in the universe. So you could have just people just beings just outside everybody's circle and never know that they exist.
Oh no, don't leave us with that thought, Alan. Please, there it is, and we don't even know. Oh. Let's go to Ed in Heartland. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you, Ed?
Excellent.
Good.
I guess my question really is a little bit closer to home. I know that there's been quite a lot of study of the planets around Jupiter, specifically Titan and Europa. And I believe it's Titan that is believed to have liquid water under their ice, under the ice the ice sheet. And because of the radiation and the gravitational pull of Jupiter, it's believed that, you know, that water may indeed below that ice surface be liquid. Is it possible that we could be looking at something even closer to home that may base on carbon or base on liquid water that could hold some type of, and I put that in quotes and underline it, life that is similar primordially to what existed on Earth billions of years ago?
That is a really fun question. And Europa, the moon you're talking about, if you see on an image of it, it's one of the Galilean satellites around Jupiter, originally observed by Galileo in 1609. It is covered with ice, and there is every thought that the water underneath that ice might be liquid. There was even from the last, I remember where I heard it, that there was a plan, unfunded NASA project, to send what was effectively a nuclear bowling ball to Europa. And what this bowling ball would do is it would heat up and melt down through the ice until it hit liquid, and then it would start taking measurements for it. Which is kind of a cool thing. And the radiation is there. I mean, there's probably been life on other planets, probably at about the same time life was emerging on Earth. It's quite possibly because the sun was putting out more energy on Mars might have been warm enough to have that life as well. But literally the sun's energy got pulled back a little. It stabilized a little, and Mars got left out in the cold. When we look at the moon Titan around Saturn, which is a fascinating moon because it's the only second place in our solar system that has beaches, except it's ethane and methane liquid on Titan. But that has the same chemicals the Earth had billions of years ago. And the only thing preventing life from forming on Titan with the same chemicals is it doesn't have the oven.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hot enough. So even if you have all the ingredients to bake the cake, if you don't have the oven to do the final thing, it's probably going to affect how your cake turns out. So I think our solar system missions are looking to that, looking to get more and more info on that, whether it's our Juno mission going to Jupiter. We have two golf carts roaming around on Mars right now. We have so much stuff on Mars that we have stuff taking pictures of our other stuff. So I think this exploration just keeps going, and we keep climbing up mountains to see what's on the other end, and all we find is more mountains that we want to climb and figure out what's over on the other side. So that's the great thing about exploration.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed, for your call. Zach in Mosinee. Hi.
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 How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Hey, Zach.
I can't complain. Just a dumb question. I'll take my answer off the air. Curious as to why we haven't been pointing any of these big old space telescopes at the planet Ceres for the last, over a decade. Like, there haven't been any pictures taken recently of that planet.
Interesting.
And thank you very much. That's basically my question.
Okay. Thanks, Zach.
Zach, I just want that Ceres... it would be CERES, which is one of the dwarf planets now. It got reclassified from an asteroid to a dwarf planet. And I think we're looking for for more things. In fact, we have a mission right now called Rosetta, which has been out for about 10 years now, and it just hit the news back in August 6th that it went into orbit around a comet nucleus of comet 67P, and it's in orbit now. It's getting closer. It mapped. And now the European Space Agency has determined 5 landing space places that they're going to land a probe on this comet nucleus probably in mid-November.
Ooh.
And now the Rosetta spacecraft and the lander, which is called Phyla, after the island in the Egyptian Nile where obelisk was found that helped decode Egyptian hieroglyphics, with the Rosetta Stone. So we have Rosetta and Phyla. And hopefully these two spacecraft, one orbiting, one riding the comet nucleus, will actually go in close to the sun and stay with this comet nucleus while it passes at its closest approach to the sun. So it's going to be really cool what we find from this. Now, why do we want to do this? Comets and these things like Ceres, which have been out in space for a long time, are like the fossils of the solar system. This is the original stuff the solar system was made out of. And if we can figure out how that works and what that's like, it's going to give us a little bit of a hint on what our early solar system was like and possibly understanding a little bit more of what's going on now.
Alan Pesch is with us the remainder of this hour, director of the Barlow Planetarium. Since 2008, he has joined us, although it's been a little while, many times to talk about the stars and the sky and life on other places and all of that, the past and the future. And he got in touch with us recently to tell us about this event we want to let you know about. It's at the UW Fox Valley Barlow Planetarium, September 5. The title of the evening, Will There Ever Be Another Earth? Friday, September 5, presented by Dr. Maggie Turnbull, and Alan will be there as well. It should be a great night. We're welcoming phone calls. If you would like to join us, our lines have been crowded, and now you could get through. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I want to let you know, actually, this is coming up pretty soon, so yeah, you got to get to the registration if you can soon. I'm inviting you to a WPR celebration in southeastern Wisconsin. I'll be talking about 10,000 interviews, my nearly 40-year career in radio, and we'll have a lot of WPR personalities there, dinner, and some books and some door prizes, and we'll all meet each other and have a good time. It's Thursday, September 25 at the Elm Grove Woman's Club, also a silent auction, a Milwaukee-themed art project, and the last day to register is coming up, so we'd like to ask you and urge you to sign up now if you'd like to be there, and we'd love to see you. They're always great events. WPR.org/Milwaukee. WPR.org/Milwaukee. Let's go to Stu in Milwaukee next. Hi, Stu.
Hi. I had a question for your guest. He'd answered a question with a statement that the Lucy Show could be viewed by another planet 50 light years away. Aren't they, the Lucy Show, traveling more like radio waves and be a lot closer to Earth still?
Dubs, you know what? That was an example I made. but it probably, they'll be traveling at the speed of light. So for every year, whenever the Lucy Show debuted, I'm not quite sure. I think it was before I was born. But those signals, everything we watched when we started creating radio signals, would be traveling out and letting people know we're there, kind of like a note in a bottle. Now, there has been some discussion that since we're doing less broadcast stuff, people are listening to their radios on online things and TV is coming through cable, maybe our footprint's getting a little smaller out there in the electromagnetic spectrum world. But yeah, all those signals we created will be traveling. They get weaker, but that's why, just like we're listening to SETI, we're looking for that something that isn't a natural, that's not natural in the background, which is kind of exciting.
So in other words, this very conversation, Alan, might be more important than we ever imagined, right?
It could be our first contact.
You never know. Thanks, Stu, very much for the call. Richard in Milwaukee, hi.
When Fonda Arrhenius in 1900 suggested panspermia, how was this idea received?
Whose idea? I'm sorry, Richard.
Yes, I got it.
Fonda Arrhenius.
Okay. Did you get that, Alan?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Oh, I thought you did.
Fonda Arrhenius was a great Swedish scientist. About 1900, he suggested panspermia, that the universe is full of life.
In fact, there's been a couple theories out there. In fact, there is one prominent scientist who once asked, "Where is everybody? If there's all this life, why aren't they here?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think our knowledge of the universe has increased in size and understanding and everything. That, I mean, we start seeing this stuff out there, and we start asking these questions. And it takes us a while to figure out what's going on. In the world of science, one of my favorite conversations I had recently was with a geologist who actually was teaching so long that the whole plate tectonics thing came out after he started teaching. So he had to change his entire look at how the world worked because science understood it better.
Right.
And as a scientist, he just, you know what, this is the way it is, and I can't hold on to the old idea, but I'll just keep moving forward with the new idea and build upon the new knowledge we know.
Hmm. Thank you, Richard, for your call. Todd wants to know on email, are we being ethical in how we're treating other planets, asteroids, comets, et cetera? Are we leaving junk on them or pulling matter from them?
Wow. I think that's a great question of looking at of even in Earth orbit for decades now. If we launch something in the Earth orbit, there was never any plan to bring it back.
Hmm.
It was just going to crash.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody cared about that. Now, from all plans of having something in orbit, there also has to be a plan to deorbit it safely. And usually by deorbiting it safely is aiming it for the center of the Pacific Ocean.
Hmm.
The Hubble Space Telescope, one of the final things they did to service it on its final servicing mission, the Hubble will not be serviced again, was to put a docking adapter on the back of the Hubble. And the next time something visits Hubble is going to be something that latches onto that docking adapter and does a control burn of it into a wide open unpopulated place. We have a lot of stuff. We've left stuff on Mars. We've left stuff in the outback of Australia with the Skylab mission, which NASA actually got a citation for polluting when Skylab fell back in the late 70s. We have several things on Mars, nothing huge. And I think that plan is always there. Now, ironically, we do worry about if we contaminate anything. We have a probe at Saturn right now called Cassini. In Cassini, one of the plans was they wanted to crash it. They usually do something at the end of the mission, pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
Except they were going to crash it on a moon Enceladus. Well, it turns out there's a geyser field on Enceladus where the temperatures are a couple hundred degrees hotter than they're supposed to be. And the scientists actually said, you know what, if we didn't use proper clean room techniques and we crash our probe in a geyser that's 100 degree or hotter that these a virus or something could live there.
Mm-hmm. Short on time.
That's not proper. So that part of the mission was scraped to do something else to make sure nothing would get contaminated.
All right. So for the event on September 5, people should go to your website to make a reservation, even though it's free.
Yep. Click on it, and you'll be taken to a page where my email is there.
Great.
Send me an email on how many tickets you want, and I'll send you back a
Thanks. All right. And it's a Barlow Planetarium. Alan Pesch, our guest. Always a pleasure to have fun with him and learn a lot. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production. And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was great fun, wasn't it? Space is fun. Until tomorrow.